Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. I hope you've had a good week. I have a great, it's a jam-packed podcast for you today. We're going to be talking about antidepressants today on The Healthy Mind. Are they necessary? Do they really work? You know, there's been so much talk about the role of antidepressants and studies that have shown, well, you know, in mild depression, maybe these antidepressants don't work. I'm going to take, though, a very different angle at it today. And really, this represents the state of the science today as it relates to depression. And I want you to think about depression today as a sore throat instead of a strep throat. That's the analogy we're going to use today. I was at an incredible lecture here this past week that really took a look at the state of the science, and I really think it's going to help to put it in perspective for you, at least depression and the treatment of it. I think you're going to be surprised at what I have to say. So we're going to be talking about depression and the role of the antidepressants today on The Healthy Mind in news. And you're really going to want to stick around for the second half of the podcast today. Following on the theme of depression and its treatment, there's the other part to this. What happens when we don't adequately treat depression? And some new data that is out there that looks at the cost, the toll that depression left untreated can have on life expectancy. Brand new data. We have to do a better job in the treatment of depression. And as I've said before, it isn't just for feeling better emotionally, getting rid of the depression. But depression echoes, and it echoes into the physical. So we'll talk about the latest data there and a very interesting study that's looked at the role of brain size as it relates to people who have depression and migraines. You're really going to want to stick around for this, a fascinating new study on depression and migraines. We're going to do some headlines, and heck, we've got ourselves a really fantastic podcast. I am really glad you're here. So, are you ready? Let's begin. Okay, antidepressants. Do they really work? There's been a lot of debate, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years. And before I get into that discussion, I want to ask you this. Have you ever had strep throat? I hope you haven't, but if you've had it like I have, it is so painful. It literally feels like there, every time you swallow, it feels like there are shards of glass going down your throat. It is so, so painful. If you've had it or your children have, you know what this is all about. And the treatment is pretty straightforward. Antibiotics that you're given after you do a strep test to make sure that that is, in fact, the reason for your sore throat. Antibiotics goes away. Pretty straightforward. A very specific illness that you have, strep throat, and a very specific treatment that you give, antibiotics. But what about a sore throat? not a strep throat. How do you treat a sore throat? And really, here, when you're looking at a sore throat, there can be so many different causes of a sore throat, right? One of them can be the strep throat, like I just talked about. Another could be a virus, a flu virus. We get sore throats pretty bad if you've ever had the flu. It could be allergies, post-nasal drip and things like that, or drying of your throat that can cause a sore throat. The fact is, there are many causes of sore throat. And in order to get sore throat under control, you're going to have to figure out what each individual person has to know how to properly treat the sore throat. Okay, fair enough so far. Why are you talking about sore throat, Zafiridis? What does this have to do with depression? I'm going to tell you right now. I was at a lecture this past week, and in this lecture, that was how it was posed to us. Think about depression as a sore throat and not a strep throat. And really, this goes to the heart of the science in depression. Why do we want to think about it in this way? Well, what we are starting to learn is that term, depression, major depressive disorder, whatever you want to call that, depression, it isn't like a strep throat, meaning the people who get depression aren't necessarily only going to have a problem with a quote-unquote chemical imbalance, if you will, where it needs to be treated with antidepressants, whether it is a serotonin drug, a dopamine drug, or a norepinephrine drug, or a combination of all of those. Don't get me wrong. Some people, many people, will be helped by that. But that's only one way to treat depression. And what we're really starting to see here is that depression really is an umbrella term to represent the symptoms that we call depression. But there's many different types of it. At least this is where the science is now going. For some people, it may be that depression has a very, very large inflammatory component. Inflammation raises in the body, and this may lead some people to these biochemical changes in the body that lead a person to depression. Other people may struggle with nutritional issues, particularly, like we've talked about here before on the podcast, folic acid deficiencies, or the ability to convert folic acid to the form that our brain can take in and build the nerves, improve our mood. Nutritional deficiencies. We're finding that obesity has huge implications, not only in the likelihood of someone having depression, the incidence of depression in those who are obese, but being overweight causes biochemical changes that can lead you to depression, and also that it can make it harder for you to respond to antidepressant or any kind of treatment. So that's a factor. And there may be other theories that we haven't even come to yet in our understanding of brain science and mood science that will increase our understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about depression. So what does all of this have to do with antidepressants and whether they work or not? Well, the fact is, the state of the science as it is today is really suggesting that depression is an umbrella term, and there can be many reasons why a person gets depressed. Whether it is the traditional understanding in terms of serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, or nutritional, or inflammation, or other theories that are being developed now, there are going to be multiple ways to treat depression in the future. The goal is going to be to really personalize the treatment. Understand for you, if I'm getting treated for depression, what is my particular type of depression? How does that manifest for me? What's going on in my body? And then tailor the treatment specific to that individual form of depression. It's a new world as it relates to depression these days. And because of the complexity and understanding where depression comes from, This may explain why using the traditional antidepressant drugs that we have, many of the common ones that all of us know, like Prozac or Paxil or Effexor or Cymbalta or any other drug over the last 20 years, the reason that we may not see total response isn't because these meds don't necessarily work, but they may not necessarily work in every person. And I think that that is a fair thing to say. It's where the science seems to be pointing to. So I go back to the analogy of sore throat versus strep throat. Strep throat, very straightforward. We know the microbe that causes it. We know the antibiotic that you can give and your strep throat goes away. But sore throat, well, we've got to take a step back. We've got to figure out why a person's throat is sore from many possibilities before we give the most appropriate treatment. And this is where depression is going. This is what is emerging. There are multiple reasons one can have relief from the traditional medications. But for some, obesity is going to be a factor. For others, nutritional. For others, inflammation. And as we start to understand it in this way, maybe we can understand why these medications don't work for everyone. But please be careful in terms of thinking that these medications don't work, period. And my motivation for saying that isn't because I'm a psychiatrist who's done this biological treatment of depression for almost 20 years, and I've got so much invested in this theory that I can't admit the obvious truth that these meds don't work. That isn't why I say that. I say it because I've seen people get better. The data is there that people respond, particularly if they have severe depression. And the data is there also that not treating depression early makes it so much harder to get response later in one's life. And this is the same for diabetes or any other illness that you let go for years and years and years. But the emotional illnesses carry a lot of stigma and bias. So it is more likely that people will not get treated for their depression and anxiety than most medical illnesses. And this has huge implications, huge ramifications for a person's life that has nothing to do with their emotions and their emotional quality of life. This mind-body connection is absolutely real, and not treating a depression or an anxiety has tremendous implications and ramifications on one's physical health and well-being. Having depression and hypertension or cardiovascular disease greatly increases the disease burden of those illnesses. We're going to talk about it here in just a second in news. The impact of untreated depression on life expectancy. And this isn't a new finding, but the latest finding. This is why we have to take a breath here. We have to challenge these models of depression. That is what science is. Looking at it and saying, you know, even though this has been right 1,000 times, you know, I came up with something over here that shows that may not be right. That's science. And it is good. It is good to challenge. It is good to find that these treatments aren't a panacea for everyone, because it has moved the science to say, wait a minute, inflammation is real. Nutritional issues matter. Obesity matters. And the science moves forward. Just don't dismiss the available treatments right now. Don't give in to that, because there's too much at risk. But do begin to look at depression as more of a sore throat than a strep throat. And because of that, it opens up huge possibilities for the future in being able to treat depression in ways that maybe we can't even imagine at this point. And hopefully, we can move that percentage of people that respond to treatments that much closer to 100%. We're moving that way. We are taking those steps. We're taking those steps towards the healthy mind. And now, it's time for news. Okay, well, another incredibly busy week of health news. The first story I thought was very, very appropriate given this week's topic on the podcast. I've talked about it a lot and will continue to. It's really a central theme here on The Healthy Mind, the importance of looking at the impact of psychological factors, emotional factors on physical illness. The mind-body connection is really, it's indisputable at this time. The emerging evidence has shown that emotional disorders, depression, anxiety, really any emotional disorder, the impact that that has on the physical well-being of an individual is huge. And the disease burden when you have depression and, say, cardiovascular disease or diabetes, whatever it may be, is amplified to a huge degree. Well, the headline here, life expectancy gap widens between those with mental illness and the general population. Now, the studies have been out there, and we've talked about them before here on the show, that really shows life expectancy in those with emotional illness, particularly if it's not treated, is much lower than the general population. It's varied, though, in terms of what are good numbers that we look at. What is this gap? How many years is it that it shaves off of your life if you're not treating these illnesses? And where is life expectancy being shortened? And it's not what you think. You know, people think you've got an emotional illness, depression. Most of the deaths that may come from that are due to suicide. But that isn't the case. This is a new study that came out of Australia, a large study, almost 300,000 people that were involved. And the researchers wanted to know, what type of illnesses do they have? Are psychological factors in place? And what impact does this have on one's life expectancy? Okay, first, in general, the population life expectancy, at least for Australia, they're increased over 20 years from 1985 to 2005, from an average of about 73 years to 79 years of age in men. And in women, life expectancy went from 79 to 83. So nice increases in life expectancy if you happen to live in Australia. But here is the impact. Among individuals who had emotional illness, if you had an alcohol or drug problem, this is what lowered your life expectancy the most. It exceeded 20 years, greater than 20 years difference in life expectancy if you've got an alcohol or a drug problem compared to someone who doesn't have those problems at all. But for all disorders combined, the life expectancy gap, really the amount of years shaved off your life because of emotional illness, well, it increased. It increased from 13 years difference in 1985 to 15 years difference in men, and then from 10 to 12 years in women. And once again, a study is showing that people with emotional illness tend not to live as long. Now, what were the factors that led to lower life expectancy in these individuals with emotional illness? And it wasn't suicide. Common factors: cardiovascular disease, complications from other illnesses, cancers. I'm telling you, one thing that we need to feel comfortable with is the impact of the psychological factors on our physical well-being. It's happening. This mind-body connection is real. And even if you don't get treatment for the emotional illnesses, depression and anxiety, to feel better, but you will feel better. There's a larger implication here on the impact that our emotions can have on our physical well-being. It may literally shorten your life. And looking at the data from at least this Australian study, the gap, even despite our treatment and awareness, isn't shortening. It's increasing. Now, in the study that was published, this was in the British Medical Journal, there was an editorial that was written by a professor of psychiatry at King's College, London. And he stated that these findings in this paper raise, quote, disturbing questions about our disregard for the duration and the value of the lives of people with mental illness. And he suggested that these interventions need to be much more aggressive. He stated, quote, this is a human rights disgrace, and that internationally agreed standards are needed to treat emotional illness. There's no time for stigma. There's no time for bias. These emotional illnesses will impact one's physical well-being. So important. Life expectancy gap is widening. Okay, now, do you suffer with migraines? Do you get migraines? And do you happen to have depression as well? So depression and migraines. Well, this next story may be just for you. I saw this and it really, really caught my attention. The headline, are migraine and depression linked to smaller brain size? Really fascinating. In this study that was done, on average, people with both migraines and depression actually had brains. Their volume of their brains was smaller than those who didn't have either depression or migraines. Fascinating. What they found was that older people with both a history of migraines and depression may have smaller brain tissue volumes than people with only one or none of these conditions. According to the study author, Dr. Loris Gudmundsson with the National Institute on Aging, he stated, quote, studies show that people with migraine have double the risk of depression compared to those without migraine. And we wanted to find out whether having both conditions together possibly affected brain size. So what did they do? Well, it involved about 4,000 people, over 4,000 people in the study. They started off in 1967 and ran it up till the present time. They evaluated them for migraines, and then many years later, between 2002 and 2006, when these individuals were about 76 on average, they checked for a history of depression, and they also took MRIs to see the size of their brain. It turned out that it wasn't all that common where people had both depression and migraines happening at the same time. That kind of surprised me, but that's what the data showed. But what was fascinating was in the individuals that had both depression and migraine, the volume of their brain, the size of their brain, was 19.2 millimeters smaller, 2 centimeters smaller than those without either condition. Now, it's important to say here that this doesn't mean that depression and migraines, if you suffer from both, means it's going to shrink your brain. That isn't what the study showed. They noticed this relationship, but they can't apply. They took the MRI one time, so it's hard to say if this is necessarily causative. Do these conditions shrink your brain? But they noticed this relationship. One of the theories that Dr. Gudmundsson had was that some of the factors leading to this effect of migraine and depression on the size of the brain may. It may include pain, inflammation in the brain, genetics, and differences in a combination of both social and economic factors. Quote, our study suggests that people with both migraine and depression may represent a unique group from those with only one of these conditions and may also require different strategies for long-term treatment. Depression and migraine sufferers. There may be some direct impact that this is having, literally, on the size of your brain. Okay, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. A common food supplement fights degenerative brain disorders. Widely available in pharmacies and health stores, phosphatidylserine, try saying that three times fast, is a natural food supplement produced from beef, oysters, and soy. A team of researchers at Tel Aviv University has discovered that this supplement improves the functioning of genes involved in degenerative brain disorders, which includes, among others, Parkinson's disease. The next headline. Aggressive behavior is linked specifically to secondhand smoke exposure in childhood. Children who are exposed to secondhand smoke in early childhood are more likely to grow up to be physically aggressive and antisocial, regardless of whether they were exposed during pregnancy or their parents had a history of being antisocial. This, according to new research from the University of Montreal. And finally, the headline, waiting for a sign? Researchers find a potential brain switch for new behavior. All right, picture this. You're at the airport. You're sitting there at the luggage carousel, standing there waiting for your bags to come out. And you look and you look and you're not moving. You just can't wait for that bag to appear. Then it appears and boom, you spring to go get it. Well, how does your brain go from sitting there passively to springing into action to get your luggage? Well, a new study from the University of Michigan may reveal the brain's switch, a switch for new behavior. And it involves a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. You can thank acetylcholine for the reason you're able to get your luggage at the airport carousel. How about that? We cover everything here at The Healthy Mind. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's just about going to do it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. I so appreciate your support. Thank you for the emails, for your comments on the website, and for taking the time to rate the podcast on iTunes. If you do enjoy the podcast and haven't done so yet, if you're listening to it on iTunes, I would really appreciate it if you take a moment to rate the podcast. It helps me out so much as it relates to visibility and having more people listen to the show. I would really appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. I tweet at Dr. Zafiridis, and any questions, comments, don't hesitate to be in touch with me. The email address, peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on The Healthy Mind. Okay, the first headline. A common food supplement fights degenerative brain disorders. Widely available in pharmacies and health stores, phosphatidylserine, try saying that three times fast, is a natural food supplement produced from beef, oysters, and soy. A team of researchers at Tel Aviv University has discovered that this supplement improves the functioning of genes involved in degenerative brain disorders, which includes, among others, Parkinson's disease. The next headline. Aggressive behavior is linked specifically to secondhand smoke exposure in childhood. Children who are exposed to secondhand smoke in early childhood are more likely to grow up to be physically aggressive and antisocial, regardless of whether they were exposed during pregnancy or their parents had a history of being antisocial. This, according to new research from the University of Montreal. And finally, the headline, waiting for a sign? Researchers find a potential brain switch for new behavior. All right, picture this. You're at the airport. You're sitting there at the luggage carousel, standing there waiting for your bags to come out. And you look and you look and you're not moving. You just can't wait for that bag to appear. Then it appears and boom, you spring to go get it. Well, how does your brain go from sitting there passively to springing into action to get your luggage? Well, a new study from the University of Michigan may reveal the brain's switch, a switch for new behavior. And it involves a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. You can thank acetylcholine for the reason you're able to get your luggage at the airport carousel. How about that? We cover everything here at The Healthy Mind. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's just about going to do it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. I so appreciate your support. Thank you for the emails, for your comments on the website, and for taking the time to rate the podcast on iTunes. If you do enjoy the podcast and haven't done so yet, if you're listening to it on iTunes, I would really appreciate it if you take a moment to rate the podcast. It helps me out so much as it relates to visibility and having more people listen to the show. I would really appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. I tweet at Dr. Zafiridis, and any questions, comments, don't hesitate to be in touch with me. The email address, peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on The Healthy Mind.